So we're going to get to see Hyunjin Ryu on the mound tonight for the Toronto Blue Jays against the Baltimore Orioles. 7 o'clock will be the first pitch on Sportsnet 590, the fan of Sportsnet. I don't want to... We spend a lot of time, regardless of the Toronto team, but we spend a lot of time pinpointing, saying this game's big, this series is big, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's been difficult this year for me with the Toronto Blue Jays because my natural inclination is to look at the schedule, to look at results and go, you know, this doesn't matter. Like, it's really not until July that you should start looking at the schedule and doing the math and saying, okay, this has to happen for this team to win this many games. And if they win this many games out of the remaining 90, that gives them this record and blah, blah, blah. There is a real sense I'm getting that the Blue Jays front office and the coaching staff thinks that we are in the middle of the most important part of the season for this team. Three games against the Orioles, three against the Rays, all-star break. Then you got a bunch against Boston. You got three interleague games against the Mets. Basically, you've got games against the teams you are chasing for the wild card spot and the team that's setting the pace in the American League East. And I'm afraid those of us who've been looking at the Boston Red Sox as doing it with smoke and mirrors probably have to put our hands up right now and go, yeah, this is, this thing's got some legs. The Red Sox, if anything, are going to be better after the deadline. So I think that explains why we've seen the Blue Jays move so quickly to address their bullpen issues with Adam Simber. Not fast enough for some people, but pretty quickly with Adam Simber and then yesterday with Trevor Richards. I think it's absolutely important the Jays put their best foot forward in these games against Tampa and the games coming up against Boston. But here's the thing about tonight's game against Baltimore. There has been so much focus on the Blue Jays bullpen, and rightly so, because it has been, shall we say, charitably a work in progress. And it's only recently that we've been looking at Hyunjin Ryu and noticing that he has not been the pitcher he was last year. He has not been the pitcher, probably for the past month, that he has been through most of his career. And it's too early to push the panic button, obviously, when you have a pitcher with this track record. But it's a fine line, right? Because at some point, a pitcher is going to lose his effectiveness. You also know, and that's going to be the product of age. That's just, you know, nobody has an endless supply of bullets. So you see that. You also have to consider that perhaps it's just one of those things pitchers go through at different points of the season. But I do know this. Given what lies ahead for the Blue Jays, given the fact that Hyunjin Ryu has had an extra day's rest, which has helped him in the past, which the Dodgers used to bake into his routine, I think a lot of people are going to be looking at this start tonight against the Orioles, even though it's only the Orioles. And they are going to need to see a dominant performance from Hyunjin Ryu. The questions surrounding the bullpen have been there now for 2 months, 7 weeks, I guess. And I think now we're starting to see some questions about the starting rotation as well, given what we've seen from Steven Matz, given what we've seen from Hyunjin Ryu, and frankly, given what we've seen from Robbie Ray the third time through the lineup. I cannot stress enough, that has to be a concern for this organization as well. Because you cannot have, we can sit here and say that it doesn't matter anymore because pitchers don't give you seven innings, but you do need to be able to count in your starting pitcher to be competitive in that sixth inning. You can't afford your starting pitcher to implode in that inning. So there's a lot to think about for the Blue Jays going into this game. Pat Tabler is our Blue Jays analyst on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet, and he joins us on Writer's Block. Pat, thank you so much for doing this. Look, I'm not going to, this isn't the biggest start ever for Hyunjin Ryu or anything, but given what happened last night, given that I think we have some questions now about Steve and Matt, it would be nice to see Ryu have one of those starts where he's just in command and everything works out. It would be nice to see that tonight, wouldn't it?
Yeah, like one of those seven innings, doesn't break a sweat kind of starts where he just mows him down, retires 10 or 12 in a row, and hopefully he can do that. He pitched pretty well his last time against the Orioles, but he didn't have his changeup. And that's been the biggest problem for him his last three, four, five starts. He has not been able to command his changeup. He hasn't been able to throw it where he needs to. He hasn't thrown it for a strike and fastball counts, and then they sit on his fastball, and he hasn't been able to command that. So we need a good one from him tonight where he just mows him down, gives the bullpen a little bit of a blow, seven innings, offense scores six or seven runs, and everybody can breathe again and just take a big, deep breath and just relax a little bit more.
I think that is the that's kind of the situation right now, isn't it? You want to see a game just go according to plan, you know. And it would be really nice if you could just see that a game just go the way you expect it to go. What do you think explains the reason for the changeup being so off? You know, I know Barker and other people, and Pete Walker's talked about this, and I think Ryu talked about it as well. His arm speed is just not what it has been in the past, and that can serve as a tip off to the hitter. What would explain that?
You know, just from me watching it, and you talk about arm speed, it's almost like he's trying to place it there. Early in the season, he was just throwing it. He was letting his arm really fire through, and it really had the guys, the batters, really messed up. And now it looks like it's in his head, and he's trying to, like, place it there or try to throw the perfect changeup, which isn't, you know, it's not possible. A changeup, you got to, like, really use your body and use your arm. And I'm not a pitcher, but, you know, I've talked to a lot of pitchers about it. And you got to throw that arm speed in there and then just let it come out. And right now, I think he's thinking about it too much, and I think he's trying to be too perfect with it instead of just, hey, just throw it as hard as you can, get your good changeup grip, just throw it as hard as you can, and let the chips fall where they may. I think that might have something to do with it.
What did you make of Steven Matz last night?
Better than his last one. Understand that he's building to some place that's still another start away, and I think that's going to be that last one right before the break. I mean, he was down for a while, and he basically stopped his routines of his workouts, his throwing sessions, his throwing programs and all that because of the COVID. And now he's got to build back up and get back into that routine and get back to where he was before he went on that. So I thought he was a little bit better than he was before. His first start, he wasn't sharp. He wasn't able to throw his pitches where he needed to. He looked like he ran out of gas really soon. Last night, a little bit sharper, had some good-looking pitches, but still not there, still not where he needs to be. And he was on a pitch count last night, 70, 75 pitches, and he hit that. I'm hoping now the next one is better. They can get him up right around 90 to 95 pitches, and he's a little bit sharper, and he takes another step in the right direction. That's the hope, and I think he can do that. But he was okay. There were glimpses of some really good pitches and everything, but then there were some where he, like, you know, made mistakes, and he didn't have the command, especially with his slider that he hung to Mullins. And, you know, I like where he went, but he's not where he was when he went on the COVID IL.
Were you a little surprised that the Jays didn't give him a rehab start that they brought him, you know, they put him right back into the majors. I understand, you know, pitching, this team does need starting pitchers. It's not like they have so many of them that they can afford to waste opportunities. But part of me did think that he would go down and at least get that one game in, you know, get that first, whatever, 70, get those first 70, 75 pitches at AAA and then bring them up.
Yeah, I did too. But, you know, when you have to defer to the player there, and he said, mm-hmm. Hey, I feel good. His side sessions, he said, was good. He threw a simulated game. I watched that. He looked like he had good stuff. You know, it wasn't really a long time. It's not like competing against the batter in a game. But the way things are right now with the starting pitching, if a guy says he's healthy, I think the Blue Jays, they have to throw him out there and get him ready. If they had enough arms, enough starters, I think maybe they say, yeah, go down and throw a rehab start, maybe two. Same thing with Delease. Delease went down and threw one inning, and he said he's okay, and he came in and he wasn't sharp at all. Go down there. But it's like all hands on deck right now. Whoever says they're healthy and they're ready to go, I think you got to go with them. You got to trust the player. And the player says that he's ready to go, I think you got to let him go ahead and go. That's just my feeling. Mm-hmm. And that's what it looked like. But, yeah, I think they would have benefited for him to have one, maybe even two rehab starts under competitive conditions, game conditions, umpires, lights, the whole nine yards. And I think it would have been a smoother transition into the game situation.
How do you think Charlie Montoyo uses Trevor Richards?
I see him. I know you saw the game against Tampa Bay. I believe that was Sunday when Colin McHugh came in and just went right through the Blue Jays batting order for three innings. I see Trevor Richards as the same kind of guy, long guy who can give you multiple innings. He doesn't throw hard, but he's smart. He knows how to pitch. I can see him as a long guy. Let's say the starter gets knocked out in the fifth and you need two, maybe even three innings from your bullpen, and he's rested and ready to go. He could be that kind of guy. I don't see him as a one inning, eighth inning guy. I don't see him as a ninth inning guy. I see him as a starter gets knocked out in the fifth. I need somebody in the sixth and seventh and maybe the eighth, or the starter gives you six and he's well rested. Everybody else banged up. Give me the seventh and the eighth. I'll pass it over to ninth when they're leading. That's how I see them using him.
Now, I know that you and Danny talked about this last night, but we've seen George Springer in the middle of the order now. What's your read on where his swing is, and how close do you think we are to seeing the George Springer that, you know, we would have seen had he been healthy?
I think he's, like, really close. I like his at-bats. I like that he's seeing the ball. He's taking some close pitches. He's got a really good eye, and I trust what he's done. And I've seen some pitches that were called strikes that he thought were balls, and he was called out on them. And the umpire, I thought, was wrong. I thought it was off the plate. So I'm seeing good at-bats, long at-bats where he's seeing a lot of pitches, and I'm seeing some hard contact. A couple of home runs when they were back home, which was a good sign. One of them was driven to dead center field. And I think he had the knock to left field the other day. So I'm seeing some good at-bats. I'm seeing a little bit more patience behind Vladdy, and I think that's what they want to have in those RBI situations, not taking anything away from Teoscar at all because he's been phenomenal. But just a little bit more of an at-bat where, you know, if you don't want to pitch to Guerrero, you're going to have to pitch to an all-star and Springer who's done some things and come up with some big hits and big situations and who has a good eye. And he'll take his walks if you want to nibble on the corners, and then Teoscar coming up after him instead of the other way around. And then and for Springer, he's got Teoscar behind him. So the middle of that lineup looks good to me, and I'm going to run with him as the number four guy right now. Mm-hmm. and let him protect Vladdy a little bit more, have a little bit more protection with Teoscar behind him, and then the rest of the lineup, which is strong. So I never thought of hitting him fourth. I was always thinking, yeah, let's hit him up at the top and maybe move everybody down a spot right there. But it makes a lot of sense having him four some you know, professional at bats where you don't strike out as much, and you'll take the walk, and a good knowledge of the strike zone, that if you get your walk, now you got another RBI guy behind him who can hit it out of the ballpark and Teoscar.
Tabby, really good of you to do this, man. Thanks so much.
Okay, we'll see you tonight.
Absolutely.
Need this one tonight for sure.
Take care.
All right, see you, Jeff.
Absolutely. That's Pat Tabler. He and Danny will have the call tonight as the Jays play the second of three games against the Baltimore Orioles at Camden Yards. The Orioles beating the Jays 7-5 last night. Hyunjin Ryu on the mound for the Blue Jays. Matt Harvey, the pitcher formerly known as Matt Harvey. Matt Harvey, 3-9 with a 7.34 ERA, will be on the mound for the Baltimore Orioles. 7 o'clock first pitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. And after the game, be sure to stick around for Jays Talk with Josh Goldberg and Sho Ali, exclusively on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. The Stanley Cup playoffs resume tonight with the Canadiens and the Lightning. Montreal looking to further extend the series. Tampa back home. Hopefully the mayor will be in attendance. I'm just kidding. Thought the mayor did a fine job, by the way, sort of covering her butt yesterday and her suggestion that the Lightning may want to lose in Montreal to give them a chance to celebrate in front of their fans. She did a fine job covering her butt, so well done to her. Brian Boucher is a former NHL goaltender. He's currently the NHL and NBC color analyst. He'll join us next. This is Writer's Block. Tonight will be Puck Drop on CBC and Sportsnet as the Tampa Bay Lightning look to wrap up their second consecutive Stanley Cup. They are leading the series 3-1. The Montreal Canadiens avoided being swept in the best-of-seven series with their 3-2 overtime win in Game 4 on Monday. And this has been it's not been an intriguing series. It hasn't been as intriguing as I think we all thought it was or thought it would be. But there have been some interesting trends that have emerged in these four games. You know, among them, you know, people talk about the importance of getting off to a quick start, and a lot of times we roll our eyes. But so far in this series, that's really held true to form. I mean, the team that scored the first goal has won all four games in this series. Tampa's 15-2 when scoring first. They're 0-5 when giving up the first goal of the game. And the Canadiens are 12-2 when they score first as well. So, you know, clearly the first goal does matter in this particular series. And it's just one of the many things we wish to discuss with our next guest, Brian Boucher, former NHL goalie, now an analyst with the NHL and NBC. And we appreciate you joining us very much, Brian, and trust that you're doing well. What do you think explains that? I understand the first goal is important. The first run's important in baseball, all that stuff. The first is usually good. But it's been so telling for these two teams in the playoffs. What explains that, do you think?
Well, good to be with you, Jeff. You know, I think it's about getting to your game and basically calming your nerves is what I look at it as. You know, like I think, you know, it's not that you want to go into a defensive shell or a defensive posture, but you know, I think when you get the first goal, it kind of settles everybody down. If you're gripping your stick, you're not gripping it any longer. I think you can. You know, if you want to get to your forecheck game, you can get to your forecheck game a little more freely. You know, and you're not pressing. I think that's basically what it boils down to: the pressure that you feel when maybe momentum is not going your way, or you know, if you've missed chances and you're feeling the heat, like you just kind of settle down. And I think speaking as a goaltender, you know, I think when your team scores for you, it kind of settles you down as well. I mean, you don't feel like you have to be as perfect. You can kind of settle into the game. I think, you know, goaltenders enjoy being the last line of defense. And, you know, there's always something great about stealing a win for your team. But if you have to do it time and time again and have to feel like you have to be perfect, you know, there's pressure that comes along with that. So I think it's more of a mental thing for a lot of the players that, you know, when you get that first goal, everybody just seems to settle down. And I think teams typically play their, you know, their systems a little bit better when they're more comfortable and relaxed.
What did you see from Montreal in game four that they might be able to take into game five and repeat the result, understanding that once you get to overtime, a lot of things have to happen. A lot of things have to go your way. Certainly killing that 4-minute penalty obviously helped as well. But were there trends or decisions you saw made by Dominic Ducharme that perhaps could be important tonight as well?
I think the changes he made were important. I think anytime you lose three in a row in a series, you got to do something. You have to change it up. And I think, you know, you put Jake Evans in, and that line was terrific. Evans, Byron, and Lehkonen, I thought were terrific. I thought they were their best line all game long. I thought they checked well, but they generated some chances as well. And also, you know, with that, Evans, you know, played a large part in the penalty kill as well. And they ended up taking Armia off the penalty kill and putting him on a power play unit. So, you know, that change was very good. The Anderson change going with Suzuki and Caulfield paid off. I think it gave him a jolt of energy. I don't think it's been a great playoff for Anderson. He's had his moments, but I think there's been too many moments where you haven't noticed them in these playoffs. And for a big guy that can skate, that should have an impact on games, I think it was great to see him have a game like he did, playing with Suzuki and Caulfield, who, you know, they are their best offensive players, Suzuki and Caulfield. So when you put a guy like Anderson on that line, he's going to get a jolt. You know, I thought they were physical. And I mean, going forward, Toffoli, Deneau, and Gallagher, you know, I didn't think they had a very good game. I didn't think Toffoli was all that noticeable. He had the turnover that led to the Maroon goal, obviously. I'd like to see a little more from that line tonight, especially if they're not going to have – it's not going to be a matchup game. I think, you know, if you can get Deneau's line or Evans's line out there against the top lines, I think that's, you know, that's preferable for Ducharme. But you can't be married to it on the road. You've got to just play, and you got to have trust in it. And I think the Deneau line, there's got to be a little bit more thought about offense from those three, in my opinion. I feel like they just need to, you know, a guy like Toffoli, he's a guy that can score. They got to think offense a little bit more and see if they can generate. But the thing that I liked about their game, Jeff, in game four was, they were physical, and they were hard on Braden Point. They were hard on Nikita Kucherov, and you could see that that was a game plan. And that's something that I think, like, I saw a little bit of frustration in Braden Point in that game when Evans got tangled up with him. You know, he had to hit post, and he made a great play to Kucherov in the third period. But by and large, it looked like they were targeting those guys. And to me, that's important. If you can get those guys to kind of come unglued a little bit, get them off their game, there could be something there. Now, I don't think it's a series just yet. I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. It's only one win for Montreal, but if they can win game five with all, you know, with the physicality that I just talked to you about and take it back to Montreal, now we've got some intrigue in this series, and there's a story there. But it's going to take another big effort from the Canadians here tonight.
It was interesting hearing you say that, because I did think when they hit iron a couple of times, there was that sense of frustration. And then when you go back and look at some of the things that happened in that game, you know, we had Gary Galley on a couple of days ago, and Gary made the point that one of the things the changes did defensively is they allowed Montreal to put a little more pressure on the Lightning in their own end, and you know, maybe play a little more a little more physically. And you really did get the impression that the Canadians had succeeded in getting under their skin, but. I mean, as you point out, you know, I look at Tampa's first two lines in this series so far, and this kind of surprised me because, you know, you assume when a team's up 3-0, you assume, well, things are going pretty well. But, you know, since game one, you know, I think what, Steven Stamkos doesn't have a point. Braden Point, I don't think he has a point since game one. Now he had 3 assists in that game. But have the Canadians done something to take Tampa's top lines out of this game? Or is this something you just kind of normally see in the playoffs, right? Sometimes two lines aren't going well. If you're the Lightning, your third and fourth line are coming through for you, and it's just kind of a thing that happens in the playoffs.
Well, I think so much attention has been made or paid to from, you know, their top players for Tampa Bay that, you know, whether it's any of the top four on the back end playing against those top two lines or if it's Deneau's line or whoever, they're paying special attention to trying to really quiet those guys. And you're right, they have done a pretty good job of it. And the penalty kill has done a good job. I thought the penalty kill was first star for the Canadiens in game four. Aside from maybe the second power play for Tampa, I thought they generated a heck of a lot of chances in that power play. And it was more of a survival kill for the Canadiens in that one. But then after that, as the game went on and into that third period in overtime, they did a terrific job of taking away seams and taking away that bumper play to point. So credit goes to the penalty kill. But yeah, they've really done a good job of shutting down the big guys for Tampa. But now here's a problem that you see, and this is the thing that Tampa has been able to accomplish in the last 2 years now that we've seen. They can win in different ways. They've added depth to their roster. Last year when they added Goudreau and Coleman, it just created more depth. And guys like Goudreau, Coleman, Johnson has had an effect on this series. Maroon scores last game. Joseph has come in and has not looked out of sorts. So, yeah, you've shut down the big guys, but now the depth scoring for Tampa is doing a good job. But you just, man, how long can you keep point from mm-hmm. having a factor in a game? Like, if he's banged up tonight, like, he took that shot from Hedman, and I wonder if it's probably not 100%, but I'm looking at point for Tampa tonight. Like, this could be a game where he breaks out tonight. And if he does, that could spell trouble for the Canadiens. I don't think the Canadiens will take five penalties like they did in game four. But, you know, they have done a good job of shutting down the big players, but they're finding out how deep Tampa really is. And that's why, you know, Tampa won last year. And it's, you know, it's why they're up 3-1 in this series.
Where's Carey's game now compared to where it was in game one, do you think?
Oh, game four was fantastic. The start for him was everything. You know, it's important. You know, you talk about the starts, the stats, you know, when you're scoring first and stuff like that. But as a goalie, if you can have an effect early on in the game, and Montreal wasn't very good in the first 10 minutes. They looked nervous. They caught pucks up. The pressure was eating them alive. And even Price had a turnover on a handle. But for the most part, he was, you know, that really settled him into the hockey game. And you just got the sense that, you know, he was determined. And but that's all it takes. You know, a guy like that has one game like that, and it can turn the tides. And we'll see if he can follow it up on the road here in game five. But, man, he was underwhelming in games one through three for me. I expected more. He was outplayed. He didn't come up with the big saves. Yeah, there were, you know, some screens and such, but you just expect more from a guy like him at this stage of the playoffs. But that was a statement game in game four. If he can build off of it and they can get, you know, like I said, I think the Deneau line, if they can get thinking a little bit more offense, because the Evans line, you know, that's a good line. That's a good defensive line. They don't have to worry about defense all the time, Deneau's line. I think they can think about going a little bit more and try to chip in offensively and spread it around. And if they do that and get a great performance from Price like they did in game four, that's where, you know, now this whole thing becomes a little bit intriguing.
Brian, really good of you to do this. Thanks so much.
All right, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Take care. It's Brian Boucher, the NHL and NBC. Again, 8 o'clock tonight, puck drop, game 5 from Tampa. The Montreal Canadiens down 3-1, looking to extend the series even further. Take it back to the Bell Center. And I think it was my friend Stephen Brunt. I know it was my friend Stephen Brunt who said that his friend, our mutual friend, Dave Hodge, of course, formerly of Hockey Night in Canada and other parts, has this theory about the playoffs. And that the series doesn't begin or the series doesn't see its biggest win until the team has won on the road. And of course, despite losing in the fourth game, we saw the Lightning win in the third game in Montreal. And if Montreal can somehow win tonight on Tampa ice, that puts a completely, completely different spin on this. The organizing committee of the Tokyo Olympics is announced today in conjunction with the city of Tokyo that there will not likely be fans during the Tokyo Olympics. I don't think this comes as a huge surprise to a lot of people. Coronavirus worries, COVID-19 worries have increased in Japan. The numbers are not great in Japan. There are still various segments of Japanese society, quite frankly, that would prefer that the Olympics aren't being held in their country. But nonetheless, they are going ahead as rescheduled, I guess is the best way to put it. For Canada, one of the points of emphasis, one of the focal points, one of the points of attention will be the pool. Of course, the Olympics in Rio saw our women's swim team really come to the forefront and become one of the stories, not just one of the Canadian stories at the Olympics, not just one of the Canadian stories at the Olympics, but one of the stories as well. Hopes are high going into Tokyo, although again, preparation has obviously been impacted by COVID-19. Kylie Maas is one of our medal hopes in Tokyo. She'll join us next. This is Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Well, there is another sports event going on besides Writer's Block. The English have just tied the Danes 1-1 in the Euro semifinal match at Wembley. I don't know if VAR is going to intercede here. I just saw the tail end of the play. But Denmark took the lead, and England has just tied it up. And no, there's no VAR going to be needed in this play. So it's 1-1 between England and Denmark. The winner goes on to play Italy to decide the Euro, 2020 Euro, which is, of course, being played in 2021 because of the pandemic, much like the Tokyo Olympics. Much like the Tokyo Olympics, which of course, are scheduled in 2020, but are now going to be played this month, or conducted this month in Tokyo. No expectation, as of yet, it seems, of fans in the stands for the events. It appears as if the authorities, because of the coronavirus, the COVID-19 numbers in Tokyo and in Japan in general, want to restrict attendance at these events. So, nonetheless, the events will go ahead. Canada, I think it's safe to say, has realistic expectations of success in the pool. Our swimmers, especially our women's swimmers, were very much a story, 2016 Rio. And it's interesting because if you think back to Rio, one of the talking points going into the games was the Zika virus and the impact, the concerns about the Zika virus. And of course, now we're talking about COVID-19. So it really, these past two Olympics, for our athletes, for all athletes, have certainly had an element of uncertainty to them that we haven't seen in the past. But this one, obviously is more challenging because whereas the Zika virus was a concern going into the Olympics, the pandemic, of course, has been a concern for over a year. If you look at the Canadian swimming program in particular, the Olympic trials were held in June. And originally they were scheduled for April. Then they were postponed to May. And again in June, obviously while Ontario grappled with COVID-19. But for a lot of these competitors, you know, it was their first time in a major pool, in a 50-meter pool, just because, again, COVID-19 had a major impact on how athletes trained, on the availability of places to train. So the build up to these games, and we talked about this with Anson Henry, and particular emphasis on sprinting. You know, the build up to these games has been different. The scheduling's been different. Athletes who were very much body clock types, right, and build up towards a certain point and want to peak at a certain time. They've really had to do a lot of this on the fly. One of those, same as every other Canadian Olympic athlete, is our next guest. She is Kylie Moss. Kylie, thank you so much for joining us today. We trust that you're keeping well. I'm sure you're excited that we are finally getting to the point where we can focus on the Olympics. I just wanted to ask you, in terms of your readiness, could you compare where you are now to where you were going into Rio, and just tell us a little bit about how different this preparation has been leading up to the Tokyo Games?
Yeah, it's been obviously extremely different for many different reasons, most prominently being just COVID and how our prep has been this whole last year leading up to this Games is completely different than 2016. And I honestly don't really look back and try and compare that, because it is so different, and there's really no benefit to looking back and trying to compare what was happening then versus what is happening now, because we can't change anything and we just need to focus on where we are right now and our preparation leading into these games. So with that being said, you know, we are just preparing as best we can, obviously, in the pool, and that's something that hasn't changed. Like, we're still able to train and do everything that we did before, like we did in 2016. So that's something that is the same, but, you know, everything else outside of the water is obviously a bit different, and just making sure we're being safe and being as healthy as possible, you know, leading into these games to prep us well for trying to be the fastest we've ever been and compete with the best in the world.
When you look at the scheduling of the Canadian the trials, one of the things that really intrigued me, and I don't know, and I understand that obviously COVID-19 had an impact on the schedule, but it seems to me that most of the major swimming nations that had already held their trials or their championships before the Canadian trial, was that an asset? Was that an aid to swimmers, you know, knowing that these are kind of what the best times in the world are right now, so it kind of gave you something to aim for? Or at that point, are we just talking about athletes being so into, I got to do what I got to do to get ready, that I'm not worried about the outside stuff?
Yeah, that's tough. I think for us Canadians, like, we've always had our trials in April. So we've always been one of the first nations to have our trials, and then we have a big block before we taper and prep for the, you know, whatever international competition is that summer. So for us to have it so late, it was very challenging for us, and it was just different for us to kind of watch the rest of the world post their times and watch the rest of the world compete, and we were still kind of eagerly waiting for our opportunity. So, you know, I think that part was hard, but at the same time, like, there's always swim meets going around throughout the world. And I mean, even during COVID, when we weren't able to swim, there were a lot of nations that were able to swim. So I think we were kind of used to just seeing it. And we recognized there were fast people swimming around the world. And that was a motivator to us and to keep pushing forward. And we knew that we would get an opportunity eventually, and we were going to be prepared for it no matter what or no matter when. So, you know, using that as a motivator, I guess, seeing other people around the world swimming fast, and then again also just focusing on what we can do every day to try and be the best we can possibly be to you know, capitalize on the opportunity of racing when it was our turn.
Kylie, I'm wondering if in some ways the fact that, you know, because media access at the games is going to be restricted, because, you know, there may not be fans in the stands at the games, and because frankly a lot of people have had a lot of really heavy stuff to deal with during mm-hmm. the pandemic, that there just there doesn't seem to be that that sort of that pounding buildup we've seen in previous Olympics in terms of media and fans' expectations. Mm-hmm. Is that helped a little bit here? Again, just kind of allowing you, because I was going to say it's almost as if there isn't as much outside noise as there is usually leading up to an Olympics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it definitely does help the athletes, just because it lessens the distractions and lessens the noise that's, you know, normally surrounding these sorts of events. And obviously that noise is beneficial, and, you know, we love that to an extent, but you can also let it overpower kind of your mind and your thoughts, and you can lose focus, you know, amongst all of that. So it has been nice to have a little less of that, I would say, and it just allows us to focus a little bit more on our job and what we love to do.
Where are you right now in terms of your, I'm not going to ask in terms of your preparation, but in terms of where your swimming is, are you comfortable where you are now? Do you feel that you're on the right trajectory going into Tokyo?
Yeah, I feel great. I think, obviously, as I said, we were all really keen to race, really eager to race at trials. And so having that behind us, and, you know, I'm confident in the swims I did there and confident in my training. And we're here now in Vancouver as a team, which is fantastic to be all together for the first time in so, so long, and, you know, be with the whole national team and just be training and really hone in our prep. On our way to Tokyo, it's coming up soon. And I'm really looking forward to it, and I'm excited.
Now, one of the swimmers that a lot of people are talking about going into the Olympics is Summer McIntosh. She's 14. She had a really good Olympic trials. This is a team, in Rio, that was a young team, and it mm-hmm. seems as if there's a real leadership core there. Folks like yourself that have been through these games, do you find that Summer's coming to you for advice? Is there sort of a realization that she is very young and you guys have had success dealing with stuff at a relatively young age?
Yeah, I think it is crazy to think that I'm one of the older ones now on the team. Like, I still can't really believe it some days, but I think it's so special to have that dynamic of having older people who have had experience on these teams before, and also having young people on the team. I mean, that's how sport works, and that's how it always goes. So I think it's a great dynamic to have. Summer's so wonderful, and 14, she completely holds her own. She knows what she needs to do in the water, and she knows we're around her to support her, and she knows that we are all here to support her if she needs anything. And, I definitely make sure I reach out to her and make sure she knows that I'm available to her if she ever needs anything, because I know at such a young age it can be so overwhelming and, obviously exciting, but also could be overwhelming. So I think as long as she knows we're here for her and, she knows that, luckily we have 11 swimmers from, our training group that are on the team, so she does have a lot of familiar faces, which I think helps as well. She's not going into a completely new environment with so many new faces. There are obviously a lot of new faces, but there's 11 people from our training group, so I think that's comforting in and of itself. But yeah, she's wonderful, and I think obviously just making sure we support her, and there's another young girl, Katrina. Having two youngsters on the team, as long as we're there to support them, I think that's all we can do.
Kylie, we just have a few minutes left. What does the CO say? The COC and Swimming Canada told you folks about what to expect there in terms of testing, in terms of quarantining, and things of that nature.
Yeah, to be honest, we haven't got too much information. We just got into Vancouver, so kind of settling here into our big national team bubble here and getting testing done these first couple of days. And I think now that we're established here and we're settled in here, we'll now get more information about the next coming weeks. So obviously we know it's going to be different. We know there's going to be a lot of protocols, and rightfully so. We want it to be a safe environment to compete in, and we're going to be ready, and we're going to be ready to adapt if we need to, but we'll be ready for whatever they say we need to do.
Kylie, listen, really good of you to join us today. Thanks so much. Best of luck. Stay healthy. Travel safely. And we wish you all the success. And we'll be watching along with the rest of the country.
Thank you so much.
Take care. That's Kylie Moss, 2016 Olympic bronze medalist, two-time world champion. And the Canadian swimmers, as you heard Kylie say, are marshaling in Vancouver. And they'll go through their intake testing and things of that nature. And then it'll be on to Tokyo. And I think the swimming, I think it starts around August 4th. I could be wrong on that date, but we certainly wish Kylie and the Canadian women's swim team, the Canadian team in general, the best. But the swimmers and the sprinters are going to be two groups of athletes that that we will be watching. In particular, you think back to Rio and just what a great story Penny Oleksiak was. And Kylie's right. It seems odd to think of Kylie as one of the older veterans on that team. But there are some young swimmers, 14 and 15 years old as well. And my goodness, I was just thinking about, you know, Summer McIntosh. If you can make the Olympics at 14, given everything that you've been faced with as an athlete during COVID, you know, the amount of learning and the amount of acclimating that she has had to do and has been and will be forced to do at a young age is really quite remarkable. As I said, we wish them all the best. It is 1-1 at halftime. England and Denmark. England getting a late equalizer. Much to our chagrin, right, Derek? Derek Brandale is just kind of looking at it. I think most neutrals want Denmark to win this game because of the whole Christian Eriksen thing. I think the untold amount of grief and disappointment that would be felt in England is not one of the reasons we want to see that. I think if we're neutral, we're cheering for the story. The NBA playoffs got underway last night. Giannis played. I don't know if that was much of a surprise. Giannis played. Phoenix won. Difficult final to sort of find a rooting interest in for me. I usually have no problem picking out a rooting interest in a thing like this. Probably want the Suns to win. Because I like to see Chris Paul get a championship. Giannis' time. Chris Paul, maybe not so much. Frank Isola joins us next to talk a little hoops. Jeff Passan as well. This is Writer's Block. This is Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jeff Blair, Stephen Brunt, and Richard Deitch on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Guest about basketball or whether he just wants to talk about the Italian soccer team who have advanced to the final of the Euro and will play the winner of Denmark and England, which is currently tied at one. Why don't we give him a choice? I mean, that seems to be the thing to do, right, Brandale? You might as well give Frank a choice. Frank Isola joining us in Writer's Block. He's, of course, co-host of The Starting Lineup and SiriusXM NBA Radio and contributor to ESPN's Around the Horn, Pardon the Interruption, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mr. Isola, how are you doing?
All right. I'm really excited about Italy. Sunday will be a big day. And if the Italian tennis player who just beat your Canadian could win, what would that match be tomorrow? Then he'd be playing on Sunday, too. We have a big day. I'm disappointed that your basketball team couldn't beat the Czech Republic in the darn semifinals because I was actually looking forward to a little USA-Canada in pool play in Tokyo, and now we'll have to wait another 4 years.
One thing, you know, yeah, it was a topic of discussion around here. There was much disappointment, but one thing we have become very good at doing in this country is sort of keeping when it comes to the senior men's basketball program, we have very little difficulty keeping a lid on expectations, to be honest. There really is a, you know, show us something first before we hitch our wagon to you mentality, which is odd because we go generally in Canada, you know, we always have this debate. Well, you know, what has to happen for a sport to really grow in the country, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there are a lot of people around Canadian basketball who would tell you that, yeah, the Raptors winning the championship was great. It obviously, you know, was a big story, but until Canada does something in the Olympics with the Maple Leaf on the jersey, it's still kind of a regionalized thing. So
yeah, I do the radio show with Brian Scalabrine. So, you know, Australia's called the Boomers, right? And
yeah.
Then you have the United States, if not the favorites, you know, we used to be called the Dream Team. And then you have Nigeria's the Super Eagles, you know, the New Zealand's the All Blacks. We say that Canada, and you use the word, we said they're the disappointments.
Yeah.
That's what always happens. And it was one thing to lose in the final. They didn't even make it to the final. Also, the Czech Republic will have one NBA player on the team.
Yeah.
I know Jamal Murray was hurt and other guys didn't play. It was disappointing. That's why they're the disappointments.
Yeah, and you could pick out a million and one excuses, but I mean, I think the one that really stands out to me more than anything else is it was just obvious that they had a bunch of guys who hadn't played a lot of ball together. And when do you tend to see that? Well, you tend to see that at the start of the game, but also down at the end, right? Where you need a player.
You're 100% right.
And guys don't have that sort of that innate understanding of where the other guy's going to be. I mean, it's one thing to see it drawn up on a whiteboard or something like that, but it's another thing to have played with a guy for 25 games and know that, yeah, he's going to get there, but it might take him a split second later to get there. Anyhow, it was disappointing, but I wouldn't say completely shocking to people who followed the team, just because there was a real sense that you did have a bunch of guys that weren't used to playing together in crunch time.
Yeah. There is something to be said for that. And even when the U.S., you know, in 2004, when a lot of the guys, you know, the more senior members of the team, it was Kevin Garnett, Ray Allen, Jason Kidd, they all elected not to play. And then the NBA had all these young guys who were coming off their rookie season who had big names, LeBron James, Carmelo Anthony, Dwayne Wade. So they stuck them all on the team thinking this would be a great marketing thing. And obviously, all three of them have gone on to have Hall of Fame careers. But in the summer of their rookie years, when you threw all these young guys together and you're playing experienced teams, the U.S. lost three times in that Olympics.
Yeah.
They lost to Puerto Rico. Think about it. They lost to Puerto Rico, Lithuania, and then they ended up losing to Argentina, obviously, in the semifinals.
Let's shift focus a little bit to the NBA Finals. Phoenix winning, I think, rather comfortably, 118-105. Look, you know, I was thinking about this coming into the office today, and sort of, you know, trying to figure out the question sports fans ask: who the hell am I cheering for in this thing? Because I do like, I'm a sports fan at heart. Who am I cheering for in this thing? And I mean, I kind of want the Suns to win just because I'd like to see Chris Paul win. I think it's kind of a neat story. I think Giannis is going to be around for a while and he'll get his chances. But what was your major takeaway from game one? You know, I don't think we're surprised. We saw, 60 points from Chris Paul and Devin Booker. But were there any other trends or things you saw in that first game that surprised you or could be particularly telling?
Well, I think they took a long time to figure out the situation here with Robin. I always call him Robin. With Brooke Lopez,
mm-hmm.
You know, he kept getting caught in pick and roll, and he was struggling to guard. If you go back to the Nets series, I thought there were times when Robin Lopez just shouldn't have been out on the court. But it worked for Mike Budenholzer. I thought there were times against Atlanta when he shouldn't have been out there. But, you know, Brooke Lopez ended up doing well against them. I think that was something. But I also think with Chris Paul, it's a good point you bring up. And I think, you know, Chris Paul understands how tough it is to get to this point because he's never been here before until this season. And I don't think, you know, when you get these opportunities, they come around very infrequently. And I don't think he's going to let this slide without him performing at his best, with keeping his team engaged. I think that's the one thing about Monty Williams and Chris Paul. It was a young team, but you had a very serious coach that brings a lot of structure. And then you bring in a very serious point guard who's going to hold teammates accountable. All that stuff is important. And that's why you've seen Phoenix, You know, it was almost pretty quietly. They finished with the second best record in the NBA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's not like they were the sixth seed and they're having this incredible run. They were the second best team record wise in the NBA. And I get the inexperience, and they caught a couple of breaks along the way, you know, with guys that were injured and certainly not having to face Kawhi Leonard as big. But guess what? Milwaukee won, and they didn't really have to face Kyrie Irving and James Harden. So everybody catches breaks along the way. It happens. When Toronto won, they didn't, you know, really have to play Kevin Durant. But you know what? It still counts as a championship. And I think, you know, the fact that Chris Paul played that well last night, you know, he went into the series as the odds-on favorite to be the MVP. And after one game, that seems to be a pretty good bet.
You know, I find one of the things I find intriguing about the Suns as well is, and there's some ways there's some similarities between them and the Montreal Canadiens, and that the Canadiens last year in the NHL bubble, they seemed to find themselves. You know, they didn't win the Stanley Cup, obviously. They didn't go on to win. But it was almost as if they took the opportunity for growth, seized it, and made something of it. And I kind of get the same feeling about the Suns, you know, just that the way they came out of the bubble, kind of with an understanding of maybe not how good they could be, but I think they saw enough advancement over the course of those eight games that they went into the offseason with a better sense of self than they may have had going into it. And they've just carried it over.
Yeah, I think those eight games for them were a godsend. I think, it served as a mini training camp for them at a time that they took off in March. And by the time they returned, it was late July. They play eight games and then they gathered again, right after Thanksgiving. And then they got back at it. And during that time, besides the fact that they went 8-0 and they played, you know, every game that they played was technical elimination game because they needed to be perfect. And they needed help to get into the play-in game. They didn't get the help they needed, but they were perfect 8-0. And then you went out and you go get Chris Paul. And I definitely think that helped them. And you think about, you know, what they've done. Now, Ryan McDonough was the GM before James Jones, who did a great job, obviously, bringing in Monty Williams to be the head coach and making the deal at Chris Paul. But let's not forget, Ryan McDonough, you know, the same year that they took DeAndre Ayton, number one overall, they made the draft day trade for Mikal Bridges. That's a starter right now on a team that's three wins from NBA championship. And they also, you know, Ryan McDonough also drafted Devin Booker. So those are technically three draft picks in their starting five. And then you add to it Jay Crowder, who, you know, is a solid veteran role player who was in the NBA finals last year. Everything really starting with the bubble, the team that really went down there with no chance really of making the playoffs and winning NBA championship was the Phoenix Suns. And now that you think about where they are since the bubble, it was like the Lakers and the Phoenix Suns probably had the best experience in the bubble.
Yeah, you mentioned DeAndre Ayton, and I would be lying if I said I watched every single minute of every single Suns game this year. But one of the things that really stuck with me in game one was the fact that, and it is obviously statistically, 20-plus points, 15 boards, 80-plus field goal percentage. I mean, he's... You know, he's up there with guys like Russell, Abdul-Jabbar, and Wilt Chamberlain in the shot clock era. I get all that. But also, he seems to be able to play defensively or to contribute defensively, not with not much of a drop-off, even when the Bucks went small. And that kind of surprised me a little bit, you know, that he wasn't yanked off the floor the minute Milwaukee went small, that he could still contribute. I think he's a much better player than a lot of people give him credit for, and has grown more over this year than a lot of people think he has.
Yeah, and the stat that they had last night, you know, having at least, 20-plus points, 15-plus rebounds, and shooting at least 80%, I guess it's been Bill Russell, mm-hmm. Kareem, and Wilt are the only guys to do it in NBA Finals. It's just remarkable, like, to do something like that. I also think for him, he kind of understands his role and that he still has to develop as a player. So it's not this attitude, well, I was the number one pick of the draft, so it's got to be all about me. He's not that at all. What I also like about him is, you know, the idea that, you know, the center doesn't belong in the NBA. Well, let's think about how well he's played at the center position, and he shoots at a high percentage because none of his shots are three-point shots. So he's actually, you know, it's nice to see that you're getting a big man who doesn't feel, you know, after he gets a couple of dunks and a couple of jump hooks in the lane, and a couple of short jumpers. Okay, now I need to stand outside and shoot from 35 feet. That's not part of his game. He just plays his game, and he always shoots at a high percentage. I mean, the guy has had an unbelievable postseason. And, yeah, is Luka Doncic better, and should they have probably drafted Luka? I would say so, but guess what? If they win three more games, it's a pretty good draft pick.
What did you make of Giannis's game?
I was really surprised. I mean, he went through the workout. You know, on TV you could see they showed him his workout live before the game, and he looked great. So that was that was good to see. And I thought, you know, the way that he played, clearly there wasn't any structural damage because he wasn't limping out there. And I thought he attacked. He played the way that he usually does. He probably didn't take enough shots. He only took 11, committed a lot of silly fouls, which hurt them. That really was the difference in the game. What were these Suns, 25-26 from the free throw line? That was the killer. But you know, I thought all in all, it was great to see him out there, and I think he'll be a lot better in game two, and Milwaukee better be better in game two, that's for sure.
You know, Frank, one of the talking points going into this series as well was the point guard, the matchup, and there were a lot of people who thought that Jrue Holiday could, I don't know if I'd say he'd be Chris Paul's equal, but that he'd certainly be able to do a decent job on him. Did you see anything in game one that would give you cause to think that, you know, that Jrue Holiday may be the answer to Chris Paul?
Well, he's got to play better. I think the four shots that he made, they were all in the paint. He does, you know, he tends to take some bad jump shots, contested jump shots. If you go back again to the Nets series, I thought he, you know, he had a couple of good moments, really wasn't doing anything. And then in the fourth quarter of game seven, when they desperately needed someone to give them something, it ended up being, Jrue Holiday. So he could be inconsistent, but he's better than Eric Bledsoe, the player that, that he was traded for.
Frank, really good of you to do this today. Thanks so much, man.
Jeff, take care. Good talking to you.
Absolutely. That is Frank Isola. He's co-host of the starting lineup on SiriusXM NBA Radio, contributor to ESPN's Around the Horn. And pardon the interruption, the Phoenix Suns taking a 1-0 lead in their best of seven series against the Milwaukee Bucks. And as you know, Frank pointed out, I mean, I think if you're with the Bucks, you got to like what you saw to Giannis. Probably have some concern about Brook Lopez and his ability to have an impact on this game, which I don't know, considering how well Phoenix shoots from mid-range, I don't know how much impact I necessarily expected Lopez to have. But you know, if you're a Bucks fan, Giannis looked good. I expected more from Jrue Holiday, but I look at the Suns, and I love the word Frank used to describe Monty Williams, the head coach of the Suns, and to describe Chris Paul as well. When he talked about serious, he used the word serious to describe them. And there's a seriousness to how they go about their business and a seriousness to the tone they set for that team. And that is the perfect description for that team. You watch them play, you really do get a sense that in a lot of ways they are the extension of their coach. And there's a reason so many people in the NBA cheer for Monty Williams. I know there's the backstory and everything, but just he's also a really good coach. And it's fun watching that team come together. And at some point, and I don't know, maybe this has been done and I just haven't paid attention to it. But at some point I would be interested in hearing somebody do a really deep dive into teams that used the bubble experience last year, whether it's the NBA or the NHL, teams that use that experience as a springboard for the next season. Because it seems to me that if you look at, let's use the Toronto Raptors as a sort of a counterexample here. The Raptors came out of the bubble after losing, and a lot of the focus was on Pascal Siakam. What happened there? It was pretty clear. It was pretty clear from talking to Fred VanVleet from hearing Fred VanVleet and other Raptors players talk. It was pretty clear that the bubble experience was not, how would you describe it? There was a certain amount of mental pressure. I don't even know if pressure is the right word. There was just a certain amount of mental intensity to the whole situation that made it difficult. And again, all things are relative when we speak about difficulty in this day and age. I get that. But the sense that the Raptors didn't have a good experience in the bubble or came out of the bubble kind of feeling not quite as good about themselves as you'd want, that kind of carried over this year, right? You compare that to the Suns, 8-0. They came out of their experience with a spring in their step, had a good offseason, and came back. And whereas a team like the Raptors never really looked refreshed, if you watch the Suns, you got the impression of a team that was very much refreshed. And I know it's not the same thing necessarily with Montreal, but I do think there are teams that underwent a period of growth in the bubble, whatever their bubble looked like, however it was constituted, whatever the restrictions were. I think there were teams that were able to use that as a springboard, for success. And, you know, we'll see now that we get back into something more that approximates a more regular off season, a regular season. We'll see how teams build on that. Because I really do believe that the impact of the pandemic on professional sports teams, it's not a 1 year thing. It's not a 2 year thing. You know, baseball talked about the having to monitor the wear and tear in pitchers' arms this year because of what happened last year. But that is going to have an impact next year as well. And we're going to see the same thing in every sport. I don't think that we will get back to a structural and scheduled normality next year with all our leagues, knock on wood. But I think the real impacts of kind of trying to make stuff work during the pandemic, I think we're going to be feeling those and dealing with those, and athletes are going to be feeling with those and dealing with those for a while. I don't think it's simply going to go away. I don't think it went away this year, and I'm not entirely certain that that'll be the case next year as well. I think we may be in line for a few years of needing to sort of reacquaint ourselves with normality, or with normalcy in terms of athletes. Jeff Passan is ESPN senior insider. The Blue Jays made a trade yesterday with the Milwaukee Brewers. They've made two trades to address their bullpen issues. They're clearly not waiting around for the trade deadline. Are there any other teams that may attempt to jump the gun as well? Jeff Passan joins us next. This is Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. There you go. The match is basically over now. Jack Grealish is on the pitch for the English. It's England 1, Denmark 1. Jack Grealish on for Bakary Saka. And the winner of this match, of course, goes on to face Italy in the Euro final. The Blue Jays get back on the field tonight at 7 o'clock. They will be at Camden Yards in Baltimore to take on the Orioles in the second game of a three-game series. The Jays 7-5 losers to the Orioles last night. Hyunjin Ryu on the mound for the Jays today. The Jays lineup is in, and as expected, Danny Jansen will start behind the plate for the Blue Jays. He kind of became Hyunjin Ryu's personal catcher. So we'll see if the extra day plus having Hyunjin or having Danny Jansen back behind the plate might provide a little bit of a boost to Ryu, who is, as we've talked about on this show and other shows for the past couple of days, he's coming off what is statistically the worst month of his career. And a lot of questions about his arm speed and his changeup, a lot of questions about his command and all. Velocity's not an issue. His velocity's been what it always is, such as it's been. But he has not been the same pitcher over the past month that he was at the start of the year, and indeed that he was last year as well. So We'll see tonight if having Danny Jansen in the extra day makes a difference against the Orioles. The lineup is Marcus Semien, Bo Bichette at shortstop, Vladdy's at first, George Springer's in center, Teoscar Hernandez is in right, Randall Grichuk is DHing, Kevin Biggio at third, Lourdes Gurriel Jr. in left, and as we mentioned, Danny Jansen behind the plate. Jeff Passan is MLB insider with ESPN. He joins us on Writer's Block. Mr. Passan, thank you so much for doing this. You will hear just one voice. They have allowed me to do this show solo this week because everybody else apparently deserves vacation time and I don't. So not that I'm complaining about it. It's actually that I don't want to throw my bosses under the bus. It's actually just the way it worked out. But anyhow, there you go.
Thanks for the update. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that you the scene has been set for you and that the picture has been painted and you're aware of what you're dealing with. So the Jays made a couple of moves to bolster their bullpen, Adam Simber, and then yesterday getting Trevor Richards from the Milwaukee Brewers. We understand the trade deadline is at the end of the month, obviously. Do you think that this might suggest that the deadline may be a little more active, a little earlier than is normally the case? Or is this, I mean, this would seem to be a pretty specific area of need for the Blue Jays at a pretty specific time in their schedule. They've got the Rays, they've got 10 games against the Red Sox coming out of the break. Those are two teams in front of them. So if you're going to address the bullpen, now would be the time to do it. But does this hint at all, do you think, that other teams may move early as well?
You know, there's been quite a bit of conversation this week, actually, more than is typically the case in the month of June. But is that going to lead to any action? I don't know. It's tough to say. I think teams are preparing. And by the way, I recognize that it's July and one of these trades happened in July. I think that teams are preparing for the draft right now, honestly, and that a lot of bandwidth is going toward there. And I think there's also a very simple fact that teams weren't anticipating the Chicago Cubs were going to be sellers, and all of a sudden it looks like they might. Mm-hmm. And if the Cubs are going to be selling, it's going to be Craig Kimbrel, it's going to be Andrew Chafin, it's going to be Ryan Tepera, not to mention Chris Bryant, potentially Javier Baez, potentially Anthony Rizzo, potentially Jock Peterson, potentially. I mean, there is quite a bit of inventory that the Cubs have. And so I think there are teams that thought, okay, well, you know, there's a pretty reasonable chance that we're going to be able to sell our guys and hold and wait. There might be some team saying all of a sudden, well, if the Cubs guys are all out there, then maybe we do move a little earlier than anticipated.
I don't know if there's been a team this year that's had a more bizarre existence than the Cubs, because they went from, you know, back up the truck to hang on, we might be in this thing, and, you know, it's a Central Division anyhow, and now we're back to what they've lost 10 in a row or whatever, and it's time to back up the truck again. How did that happen?
it's frustrating to try and analyze the Cubs, because in May they looked like they were actually a good team, and then June came along and they had a tough schedule, and, you know, it looked like going toward the end of the month, you know, I think going into the last week of the month, they were around 500 for the month of June, and that they were going to stay there with Milwaukee. And then all of a sudden they just stink. Mm-hmm. And the Cubs, mind you, they hit 186 in June, Jeff. Like, they were bad offensively, and their pitching kept them afloat. Now their pitching's been a disaster, too. And even though their bats have picked up a little bit, it's just been one of those things. You see it in baseball all the time, where one part of your team's playing well, the other part can't do anything. And that's where the Cubs are right now. They can't string together, the pitching, offense, and defense at the same time. And accordingly, they're down 11 games in a row. And I'm sorry, but good teams, playoff teams, tend not to have 11-game losing streaks during a season.
Do you think maybe we you mentioned the draft is coming up, and that there's, you know, it's not necessarily that organizations can't walk and chew gum at the same time, but the draft is, you know, it's labor intensive this year, especially, I would think, because of the fact that we've had such an odd, you know, an odd lead up period to it. But do you think maybe we underestimate just how much energy organizations spend on the draft. You know, I think it's not as ballyhooed as the NBA draft or the NFL draft. So I think we still think that the Major League Baseball draft is, you know, four guys in a room going over video and, you know, pulling lots to see who gets a pick. There's a lot more involved in the draft on the part of Major League teams now than I think a lot of people think, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, it may not be ballyhooed, but even in this year of a shortened draft, we're talking about 20 rounds. I mean, you know, in a normal year, it's a 40-round draft. And, you know, teams have area scouts, you know, at least a dozen area scouts who patrol territories. They have cross-checkers. They have a scouting director. They have a general manager. I mean, they have all kinds of people who are putting input into the draft. And you have to figure out, if you're an organization, not just what kind of talent you like, not just what kind of guys you want to target, but where you are in your life cycle and how quickly you're going to be competitive. You know, a team like the Jays, you could see them because they feel like their window is right now, potentially going after a college guy who could ascend through the organization quickly. And I understand that in recent years they had gone with some high schoolers, you know, Groshans being the prime example. But Alek Manoah, I think, is like a best case scenario, and you see how quickly he's ascended and how good he's looked. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the thing. You know, Ryu's been bad the last month. Robbie Ray has been very good. Ross Stripling has been very good, and Alek Manoah may be the best of them all.
Yeah, no, it's been, I think a lot of people looked at Alek Manoah, and I think a lot of us, and I'll put my hand up here too, were wondering how we would react to that ejection in the Orioles game. And, you know, he's come back and he seemed to made a few changes, I'm going to say, to his mound demeanor. Nothing to take away his aggressiveness or that, but it has been remarkable watching this kid grow. And, you know, I'm looking forward to that discussion when we start trying to figure out how many innings he's going to be able to go, because right now he is, if you look at the Jays starters, Robbie Ray's had issues the third time through. The numbers are awful. Even with Stripling, like, I think if you asked a lot of people right now, who could go eight innings, hit that magical eight inning mark, Manoah might be the guy, because he just appears to be built and wired for that. You know, which is
here's the good thing. You know, you see big league starters right now have thrown, you know, the best among them have thrown 90 plus innings. You know, so I think a couple guys are over 100 at this point. The fact that the AAA season started a month after the regular season will behoove guys like Manoah. Mm-hmm. He's thrown only 55 innings this year. Yeah. So. I think he threw fewer than 20 innings in his debut. He threw none last year. And so in my head, the Jays probably want to target somewhere between 120 and 130 innings.
Mm-hmm.
But if they take Manoah over that, if there's a playoff spot on the line and they need him, they should use him. I would love to say that organizations know how to keep players healthy. I don't think they do. And because of that, I think that an organization going for somebody like Alek Manoah and telling him, we're going to push you a little bit, it is not an unreasonable thing for them to do. Like, economically, it just makes a lot of sense. Get as many pitches out of a guy as you can before he hits free agency. And that's an extraordinarily capitalistic way to look at baseball, and it commodifies players. But the reality is, a player is as good as what he can provide for you. And beyond, you know, those 6.5 years of control they're going to have over Alek Manoah, the Blue Jays can't really be thinking beyond that.
Right. It's been a couple of weeks now since Major League Baseball has cracked down on the sticky stuff. The drama seems to have gone away, in that I have not seen as many pitchers stripping down as we've seen in the past. It seems as if the on-field, it seems as if, you know, after the Max Scherzer stuff and the Sergio Romo stuff, it seems as if it's just kind of proceeding apace now. I don't know if that necessarily means pitchers have accepted it or they've just decided that at this point it's like it's banging your head against the wall and there are better ways to use your energy. Yeah. Has it had an impact? And I know that you wrote an article on this on ESPN, asking the question, what will July bring? So I'll ask you that question as well. Has it had an impact? And what will July bring as a result of it?
It definitely has had an impact. All you have to do is just look at the average spin rate from the first 2 months of the season to now on four-seam fastballs, and it is significantly different. And I think July is probably going to bring a stabilization. I think we're going to have a much truer sense of what guys' natural spin rates are. And it's going to be really interesting, Jeff, going forward in free agency, in the valuation of trades. Like there are guys whose fastball RPMs have dropped, 150, and teams just don't look at them nearly as valuably, I think, as they did in the past. We never knew what guys were like naturally. Now we know. And so it's advantageous to teams that are trying to get a sense of, what are these guys and how do we value them?
The L.A. Dodgers made kind of, I don't know if you'd call this a surprising move today, but it was out there in social media that they've removed all Trevor Bauer merchandise from their online store and from their shop, I guess, at Dodger Stadium and some of their other retail outlets. We know that he's on administrative leave, and we know the details of the allegations. Is there a chance that this contract is voided?
I can't fathom a scenario in which it's voided.
Okay.
And I say that not based on the allegations, not based on anything, Jeff, but past precedent.
Okay.
Because there have been baseball players who have gotten into trouble with the law, and they still have been paid out, not their full salary, but extremely close to it. I think the incidents, what teams try to do is it's called convert a contract. And when you convert or when you attempt to convert a contract, you're trying to take it from guaranteed, which all major league deals are, to non-guaranteed,
okay,
where you could then go ahead and void it. Attempts to convert in the past have failed pretty spectacularly. And by that, I mean, I think the case of Denny Nagel when, I believe the allegation was that he had solicited a prostitute. He ended up going into a case with the Atlanta Braves where he ended up getting paid, I think, 95 cents on the dollar. And I think the Orioles tried to convert the contract to Sidney Ponson, and I think he got something like that. So the notion that Trevor Bauer's three-year, $102 million deal is just going to go vamoose and vanish, no, that's not going to happen. I mean, if the Dodgers hope to recoup money, they would get it in the form of a potential suspension.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would be the likeliest way that they can do that. Now, it's way too early to speculate that there's going to be a suspension. But we know in past cases of domestic violence alleged in Major League Baseball that even players who were found not to have committed some of the things that the original allegation said, they ended up getting suspended for limited periods of time. Now, this is a different case. I mean, this is a case where Bauer is not straight up denying some of the allegations, but he is denying the one that is most material, which is that he sexually assaulted a woman. And I do wonder, and I don't know the answer to this, I do wonder if there's any potential penalties or repercussions for the things that he has admitted to.
Mm.
And it's a fascinating case because of that, and one that, honestly, I wish we didn't have to talk about, because a woman ended up with two black eyes, a bruised face, a swollen jaw, a cut and bruised lip. I mean, it's really ugly. And I can understand why the Dodgers went and did what they did. What I wonder is, does it portend something else? Is this an indication of how the Dodgers are starting to view Trevor Bauer, where they're trying to separate themselves from him? And if so, how is that going to manifest itself going forward?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing I was, you know, I understand there's an issue of optics here, but it just seems, and I get, and I'm sure if you're an organization, you probably would do that. But man, when you remove a guy's merchandise, I mean, it's just, it seems to be, almost a statement of kind of we kind of know where this is going, you know?
Right. Right.
And
yeah, I mean, the Dodgers have not come out with any statements in support of Bauer at this point, but we also have to recognize that those statements of support can turn around when we get the full accounting of what happened and really harm a team. I mean, if you remember, Julio Urias, a member of the Dodgers as well, faced domestic violence allegations too. And the Dodgers, they didn't take his merchandise down.
No, that's very true. Mr. Passan, as always, we appreciate your time. Thank you for doing this. Stay safe. Be well.
Same to you, my friend.
Take care. That's Jeff Passan, MLB insider with ESPN. And the Trevor Bauer story is intriguing. And the just the reaction of the organization to it. And the Dodgers took a lot of grief, and it was almost as if the Dodgers were essentially sort of waiting for Major League Baseball to make the decision for them. And I kind of get that at times, but boy, that's an awfully, awfully fine line to walk in this environment. I mean, it really is. And you saw they received some blowback right away. Dave Stewart, for example, saying he would not return to a Veterans Day event because of the way the Dodgers handled the Trevor Bauer situation, not suspending him right away. Dave Stewart very much saying, look, you need to have, it's one thing to talk about having zero tolerance for these types of things, and it's another thing to walk the walk. And he was just reading his statement. You really got the impression that he thought the Dodgers had really just handled it. And you know, this is an organization, you got to remember, that used to be run by a family. And there was a sense that, that family was certainly not, the O'Malley family, certainly not above, some questionable things when it comes to land acquisition and things like that. There was a sense that they had a little, they were a little more sensitive to some of these things. And so as we said it, Trevor Bauer's on administrative leave. His merchandise is out of the Dodgers shop. Take that for what you think it may mean. It is 1-1 Denmark and England. England pressing. We're into added time right now in the match. We'll take a break and come back. Get you set for Tim and Friends. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Well, if you were watching Trent Thornton pitch last night and said to yourself, oh my God, I hope that's the last I see of him, I can't guarantee that he's gone for good. But I can tell you that to make room on the roster for Trevor Richards, the Blue Jays have optioned Trent Thornton to AAA. Trevor Richards is with the team in time for tonight's game, the second of three against the Baltimore Orioles. 7 o'clock, first pitch on Sportsnet and Sportsnet 590, The Fan. And there you go. It's taken us 3 years to figure out what Trent Thornton is, and I'm not certain we know yet. But it's pretty clear, I think, that whatever he's going to be, he's more than likely going to have to figure it out at AAA. And as we mentioned, the Jays are an important part of their schedule. Never mind the Orioles. They've got three games against Tampa coming up, and then they've got a whack of games against Boston. So their season is very much going to be in the balance in the next 3 weeks. And I think you get a sense that this organization is the point now where the arms that they have in the bullpen are going to be arms that they want to trust or think they can trust or believe they can trust. And as a result, Trent Thornton has been optioned to AAA. I don't know, maybe stretch him out as a starter. I don't know. I know that Thomas Hatch pitched pretty well last night coming off the 60-day IL. And I would imagine that at some point soon you'll see Thomas Hatch up here. We also know that Ryan Borucki was transferred to the 60-day DL yesterday. That was more or less a paper move. We also know that Julian Merriweather is reportedly making some progress, although, again, with Julian Merriweather, there's always concerns that progress could be curtailed. But that's where we are right now, going into the second game of that three-game series. Trent Thornton has been optioned to AAA. Trevor Richards will be available tonight. Hyunjin Ryu on the mound. Danny Jansen in the lineup. First pitch, 7 o'clock on Sportsnet 590. The Fan and Sportsnet. Got NHL hockey tonight as well. Tim and friends will get you set for everything. They'll take a look back, no doubt, at Denis Shapovalov's big day at Wimbledon as well. So lots ahead on Sportsnet 590. The Fan. As for us, we'll be back tomorrow from 2 to 3 with Baseball Central and Writer's Block. Solo will be back from 3 to 5. Have a great night.